Falter-Podcasts werden durch Werbung unterstützt. Das hilft bei der Finanzierung unseres journalistischen Angebots.
Hereinspaziert durch unser Burgtor. Ob Burgherr, Ritterin, Stallbursche oder Gauklerin. Die Burg Liechtenstein in Maria Enzersdorf bei Wien lädt zu Erkundungen ein und weckt bei Groß und Klein die Abenteuerlust. Erbaut im Jahr 1130, ist die Burg bis heute zu 60% im Originalzustand erhalten. Waffenkammer, Turmzimmer und Ritterstube. Die Stammburg der Fürstenfamilie von und zu Liechtenstein bietet Einblicke in das Leben im Mittelalter. Besuchen Sie uns jetzt in der Erlebniswelt Burg Liechtenstein. Jeden Sonntag mit eigener Kinderführung. www.burglichtenstein.eu.
Falter Radio.
Hallo und herzlich willkommen im Falter Radio. Mein Name ist Katharina Kropshofer und mein Kollege Benedikt Naradoslawski und ich hatten diese Woche eine besondere Interviewpartnerin vor dem Mikrofon. Sie ist eine globale Ikone des Naturschutzes und zählt zu den bekanntesten Forscherinnen der Welt. Jane Goodall, mittlerweile 88 Jahre alt, prägte mit ihren Studien zu Schimpansen die Sicht auf unsere nächsten Verwandten und damit auch auf uns Menschen. Am 31. Mai kommt sie auf Einladung des Jane Goodall-Instituts nach Wien, um einen Vortrag über Hoffnung zu halten. Wir haben die britische Verhaltensforscherin vorab via Videokonferenz zum Exklusivinterview getroffen, um mit ihr über ihre Zeit in den 1960er Jahren im Dschungel Tansanias, ihre Erfahrungen als junge Wissenschaftlerin inmitten älterer Männer und über Hoffnung in Zeiten des Artensterbens gesprochen.
So let's start with the past. You have been in the wild and nobody studied chimps like you did. As you wrote in your iconic article in National Geographic, you saw chimps in the wild hunt and kill for meat. And you were even attacked by a chimp. So I learned that he slammed your head from behind. And once you climbed on a tree when you were confronted with two buffalo bulls. So did you ever fear this life in the jungle? And if you did, how did you overcome this fear?
Well, first of all, it was my dream since I was 10 years old. And I believed that animals wouldn't harm me because why should they? Unless they'd been, you know, themselves attacked and hated humans. And so I had that feeling with me that nobody's going to harm me. When that chimp hit me on the head, it was just like in passing, you know. The buffaloes, they didn't attack. So although people say, well, it was a bit naive of you to think they wouldn't hurt you, they didn't hurt me. So maybe it wasn't so naive after all. So of course there were moments when you had a moment of fear, because that's important. That gives you adrenaline. So maybe you have to quickly climb a tree and the adrenaline lets you climb a tree you couldn't climb without it. So I always had a fear of leopards. So when I met a leopard very, very close, that gave me a moment of fear, but you know, the leopard didn't hurt me either. So I didn't have very much to overcome.
You were proven right for your method.
Yes.
And speaking of which, there were a lot of people that told you at the time, you know, you can only observe these chimps if you don't get too close and you hide a bit, but you didn't hide, you wanted to come closer. Why didn't you? Why did you choose to, you know, choose your own approach?
No. At first, I didn't exactly hide because they always knew where you were. But if there was a fruiting tree, what I did, I built a little out of palm fronds. They knew I was there, but it became, they got to understand if I was there behind my palm fronds, I wasn't going to move out and scare them. So that was my method. And why did I want to get close? Because I wanted to identify them as individuals, because I wanted them to allow me to be not exactly part of the group, but a very non-threatening creature that they didn't totally understand, but that wasn't harming them. It took a long time, 4 months. 4 months before the first one, David Greybeard, began to accept my presence.
You have written that it was very frustrating in the first month because they were they went away when you came there. But how did you gain the trust of David Greybeard?
Oh, he just got used to me. And every chimpanzee is different. So David was more relaxed than the others. The great thing was that after the 4 months when David began to allow me closer, he helped me to gain the trust of the other chimps. Because if I approached a group which was ready to run as usual, but if David was there, they would look from him to me and back. And I suppose they thought, well, she can't be so scary after all. So in a way, he introduced me to all the other chimpanzees of the community. Some remained fearful for at least another 5 or even 6 months. And there was one female and her family. And even when I began having students and field assistants, I was always the only one that she let near. I was very proud of that.
I can imagine. And you just mentioned that, you know, there were other ones as well. There was Mrs. Max and Spray. But it was quite unusual to give animals names. And some people would say, you know, it was anthropomorphizing in a way. Why did you choose this personal approach?
Well, I'd always had animals. I hadn't been to college. I didn't know anything about arrogant science. And why wouldn't I give them names? You would have given them names. I mean, when they said you should have numbered them, that scientific, I thought, well, to hell with that. I mean, I'm sorry, but if you got up to number 45 and you had to remember 37 and 29, how would you possibly remember those numbers? I hate numbers anyway. As I hadn't been to college, when they told me I should have numbered them and that I couldn't talk about their personality, their minds or their emotions, because those were unique to us. Well, I'd been already taught as a child by my teacher, Rusty, up there. That Rusty. Of course animals have personalities, minds, and emotions. We're not the only beings on the planet. And of course now we know that it's not just humans and chimps and dogs. You can go right down to the octopus and find animals have intelligence and emotions.
So it was a big advantage that you didn't have a university degree or something. So
absolutely. Of course, Leakey made me get one later, and that's when I was told I'd done everything wrong. But luckily, you know, I was 27 by then, and I managed to get to Gombe, save up my money, start the chimpanzee study. I had Leakey's trust. And so how did you stand up to those, you know, dominant males? Well, I didn't fight with them. I just quietly went on talking about the chimpanzees the way they were, the way they are. And then the Geographic sent Hugo van Lawick, and he took film. And so when the film came out of chimpanzees tool using and showing all these gestures and postures so like ours, then scientific community gradually changed. But we never had an outright confrontation because that's not my way.
You've already mentioned it. Your findings, they were groundbreaking, like that chimps are using tools, and the image of the man as the tool maker was abolished. So it was an end of a dogma. You also found out that chimps eat meat and that they are making war to other groups. So did you also learn something about us humans in your field study?
Yeah, well, because chimps are more like us than any other thing, you know, DNA, we share 98.7% of our DNA with them. And their postures and gestures, you know, kissing, embracing, holding hands, just so like ours. It means that you can stand back and say, well, but we are different. I mean, humans are different. Chimpanzees don't talk on Zooms like this. What is the main difference, we can then say? What does make us unique? And it's this explosive development of the intellect. So I think that was triggered sometime in our evolution. We learned to use words or gestures. It doesn't matter, signs meaning something. And that meant for the first time we could teach children about things that weren't present. We could learn lessons from the past, although we're not very good at that even now. We could make plans for the future. And perhaps most important, we could bring people together with different ideas to discuss a problem and hopefully find a solution.
But you also found out that also chimps are communicating with each other, right? So they are using sounds, and you say who and so on. So they have different sounds for different emotions.
Well, they communicate with postures and gestures, which are the same as ours. We use that communication as well. But in addition, we got spoken language, and that, I think, triggered this development of the intellect. That's the difference, according to me.
I'm just wondering, when we study animals, does it make sense to always compare them to humans, or is that something that we can even get rid of to not do that and just try to see them as the individual or a group?
Well, we should see them in their own right, but for most people, what fascinates them is the level of an animal's intelligence and the kind of behavior they can do, and sort of almost automatically compare that with our behavior, because it's so dramatic sometimes. Emotions, happiness, sadness, fear, despair, anger, grief, they're all there. And so it turns out that they and other animals share our emotions. And at one time, when I went to Cambridge, I was actually told, and it was written in textbooks, that's 1961, that the difference between us, humans, and all other animals is one of kind. In other words, there's a sharp line. We're here on our pedestal, different, special, God-given, and then down there, it's all the others. And the chimps helped to break down that barrier. Part of a continuum, and the difference is degree, not kind.
What was it like that a young woman had this unbelievable stuff coming up and this groundbreaking findings in an academic world which was dominated by white male professors? How did they react to your findings?
Well, at first, they discounted them. But actually, if you can thinking about studying in the wild, it wasn't male dominated. There were two men at that time and me. That was the only people out in the field. So it was hardly dominated by males, that part of it. But of course, going to university, you come up against all the others. But one very lucky thing for me, I would have stood up to it anyway, just quietly gone on. I didn't want to be a scientist. I didn't care if I got the degree, except to please Louis Leakey. And I had one of the very top three ethologist animal behavior people in the world. And there were three of them, all European. And it was Tinbergen, Conrad Lorenz, and Robert Hind. And I got Robert Hind as my supervisor. And at first he was a very stern critic, but then he came to Gombe for 2 weeks. And he wrote to me afterwards, I learned more about animal behavior in those 2 weeks than all the previous rest of my life. And so what he did for me, he helped me write my unorthodox ideas in such a way that scientists wouldn't be able to criticize me. And that was incredibly important because, A, I loved learning how to think as a scientist logically, and B, it helped me, get out into that world so that people took my observations of the chimps seriously.
Was it you who convinced them, or was it also the chimps that helped,
The chimps. I said it was the chimps that helped break down that barrier.
Yeah, that makes sense. Is it...
I was their interpreter, so...
That is a nice way of putting it, yeah. We were just wondering, because, you know, in the world of great apes, there were three women that stand out when it comes to studying them, so-called trimates, I think they're called sometimes. So Diane Fossey and Birte Galdikas. Do you think that was a coincidence? Or is that, yeah, is there a...
It was because Louis Leakey had the idea that females would be more patient and therefore make better observers. So he deliberately picked women, like he deliberately picked me because I had not been to university, nor had Diane Fossey. Birute was the third, and she had been, she did have a degree, but she was number three.
And do you think that's true? Are they better observers?
Well, you know, we all have male and female in us, and there are some men who are just as patient. But I think back then, one thing that's important to realize, that it was a different world. Feminism hadn't really emerged. And so the prevalent idea was the man was the breadwinner and the woman would do whatever and then get a husband. That was the sort of, you know, accepted norm. So for a man out in the field, he'd want to get his degree and to get a job, to have a family. Whereas the woman could be out and sit there and wait for the white knight to come riding along on his horse and carry her away. I mean, it wasn't conscious thinking, but that was actually the way it was.
But you wrote that, for example, the authorities were unwilling to allow you as a woman to go off into the bushes by yourself, so you had to bring your mother with you.
Well, it didn't have to be my mother. It was the, you know, it was the end of the British crumbling empire. Tanzania was originally Tanganyika, part of German East Africa, and we took over the British after World War I. And so it became Tanzania and independent in 1961. But when I began in 1960, it was still administered by the British. They were the ones who said, this is ridiculous. A young girl on her own in the jungle, it might be dangerous. But in the end, because Leakey never gave up, they said, all right, but she cannot come alone. So it was my mother who volunteered, not that I had to come with my mother.
Did you like it?
Having mom, it was amazing. One, she boosted my morale when the chimps were running away. She was always there saying, when I got down in the, I mean, she never came in the forest with me. But when I got down in the evening, she would say, but Jane, you're seeing a lot with your binoculars and you found this peak and you're learning about making nests at night and the calls they give and the size groups they travel around in. But she also, even more important, she set up a little clinic and she handed out simple things like aspirins and Band-Aids and things that people don't use anymore, like saline drips, which work wonderfully, by the way, and things like that, Epsom salts. And so she established a wonderful relationship with the fishermen along the beach of Lake Tanganyika, and they began coming from further and further away. So she established a really good relationship for me with the local people.
Did she fear that something could happen to you, or was it okay for her that you go into the jungle, into the wild jungle?
She seemed to accept it okay.
She knew you. Yeah. When we look at science today, I mean, things have changed a lot how we do science since you were an active researcher. Do you think this kind of, you know, patient observation and this type of behavioral biology is still the same today, or has it changed? Is it still possible to do it this way?
Well, there's a lot more technology used, which is very, very useful. But we still need the long-term patient observations to really get the details of personality and so on. But, you know, camera traps and artificial intelligence, which can identify individuals from the photos. So like in Congo, where we work, I think it's a total now of 40-something individuals recognized from camera traps. They've all got names, and, you know, slowly people are learning more about them. So there's a lot of technology, like perhaps most important of all, GPS, GIS, so that, you know, you make an accurate map of where the chimps are at any given time.
These days, we are celebrating the International Day of Biodiversity, and our nature is the state of nature is really shocking. So Earth is heating up at an unprecedented speed, and we face the sixth mass extinction. According to IPBES, 1 million species are threatened with extinction. What would be your message to politicians, CEOs, and other decision makers?
Well, my message is that we have to realize we are part of the natural world. We depend on it for everything. Even in the middle of an inner city, we depend on the natural world for food and water and so on. But what we depend on is healthy ecosystems. And an ecosystem is made up of this complex, interwoven, interdependent plants and animals. And so if we imagine it as like a great big living tapestry, beautiful live tapestry, and every time a little plant or animal goes extinct, we pull a thread from the tapestry. And if we pull enough threads, that tapestry will hang in tatters. So what politicians need to realize is if we carry on disrespecting the natural world and animals, it's going to be the end of us. And already it's led to climate change, and our disrespect of animals actually has led to the pandemic.
Yeah. Once we've understood that, what do you think, what is the first thing we need to do to stop destroying our planet?
Well, I think we have to realize that every day as individuals, we make some difference. Depends who you are and what you do and your position as to what sort of difference you can make. But unless people are really poor, and there's far too much poverty in the world, not just in the developing world, but also, you know, in America, England, and probably Austria too, I'm not sure. But so, you know, in order to survive, poor people will destroy the environment because they need land to grow food, populations are growing, they ought to make money from charcoal or timber. In a city, the poor will buy the cheapest junk food. They can't afford to ask, as we can, which is answering your question. We can say, did this harm the environment in its making? Was it cruel to animals, like in a factory farm? Is it cheap because of unfair wages in other parts of the world? And if the answer is yes, 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 don't buy it. And poor people, of course, just have to buy the cheapest. But we can all make a difference by what we buy, how we interact with people, and then doing what we can do. If you're a teacher, you can teach about it, so can you if you're a parent. If you're a politician, although you may be fighting at the moment a losing battle, you can support bills that are protecting the environment. So, in places like Brazil, those laws won't pass. And even if laws are passed somewhere, like in America, and Trump came along and trashed them all and turned them all around, so now Biden is turning them back again. It's ridiculous.
Just to get back to your point about poverty, if we solve poverty, does that mean, you know, these other problems will be solved as well in a way?
Not exactly like that. But when I became involved in poverty was when I realized how fast forests and chimps were disappearing. And I went to Africa to find out more about the problems of the chimps. And that's when I realized that so many of the people living in and around chimp habitat were crippling poverty, lack of good health and education, degradation of the land, growing populations moving further into the wilderness. And when I flew over Gombe National Park, is very small, the smallest in Africa, in Tanzania. And when I arrived in 1960, and right up until the beginning of the 80s, I would say. It was part of this great equatorial forest belt going over to the West Coast. But when I flew over in the late 1980s, it was a little island of forest, and all around the hills were bare. And that's when I realized people are cutting down the trees in order to survive. And it hit me, if we don't help these people find ways of living without destroying the environment, we can't save chimps, forests, or anything else. We started our program, Take Care, or Tukari. You can look it all up, but it's very holistic. And, you know, one of the reasons for hope is how nature is resilient. So if you fly over Gombe today, there aren't any more bare hills. The forest has come back because people have other ways of making a living.
And how did you manage that? How did you help those people?
Well, unlike other conservationists at the time, we didn't march into the 12 villages around Gombe and tell them we were going to do this, that, and the other to make their lives better. No, we selected, I think it was 7 local Tanzanians from just around Gombe. And they went into the villages and sat down and asked the people, what can JGI do to help you? And of course, the first thing was, we need to grow more food. Our farmland is overused and infertile. So job number one, restore fertility without using chemicals. And we managed to do that. The second thing they wanted was better health and education. We worked with the local Tanzanian authorities and then raised some money. Some villages had no clinic at all. So we built little clinics and, you know, gradually improved things there. And then we were able to add water management programs, scholarships to keep girls in school, give them a chance of secondary education. Because all over the world, it's been shown as women's education improves, family size tends to drop. And they were having 8 to 10 children per female when I arrived. And it's impossible. You know, this is still happening, but much less. And that we also provided microcredit opportunities based on Muhammad Yunus's Grameen Bank. He actually took me to Bangladesh and I met the women who for the first time had money in their hands, changed their lives completely. And so that program is now in 104 villages through Chimp Range in Tanzania, and it's in 5 other African countries as well.
And so how are the chimps today? Are they? Is there a growing population again? Or?
Well, some of the villages have now agreed to leave corridors so that, because the Gombe chimps were isolated and their numbers had gone down. But now there's corridors linking them to the north and the south. And I think in the last 3 years, we've had something like 6 females with new genes coming in. So we've stabilized. It's less than it was, but then it was more because it was more forest outside the park. So it seems to be stabilized now. And, you know, because we've got our youth program in all the schools, children are beginning to understand. And because we have worked with the people, they've come to understand that saving the environment isn't just for wildlife, which they thought that's what we wanted, but for their own future. So they've all become our partners in conservation, which is why the trees have come back.
In your book, Hope, you say we are facing 4 challenges. One is ending poverty. The second is changing the lifestyle of rich people. And then you say something very interesting, that also ending corruption is a very main topic for the environment as well. Can you elaborate on that?
And the other one, the fourth one, is population growth.
Yeah.
You know, with 7.9 billion on the planet now, an estimated closer to 10 billion in 2050. If we carry on with business as usual, what's going to happen? So we have to think about that, even though it's supposed to be politically sensitive. It's a major problem. We have to address it and think about it. And one way I've already mentioned, improving women's education. That shows family size dropping. So our number has dropped around Gombe. So, you know, what I see at the moment is the human species, we're at the mouth of a very long and very dark tunnel. And right at the end of that tunnel is a little star shining. That's hope. So there's no point sitting at the mouth of the tunnel and saying, oh, I hope that star comes here, because it won't. We have to roll up our sleeves and we have to crawl under, climb over, work our way around all these obstacles that you just mentioned, the corruption and the loss of biodiversity and all the rest of it. And we have to persuade others to come with us. And fortunately, there are around the world people tackling all these different projects, you know, loss of soil, deforestation, climate change, and so on. What we must do is come out of our silos. You know, people tend to think only in terms of, well, loss of the soil is really important. We got to do something about it. Other people think, something else is really only important. But we need to get together and help people understand that it's all interconnected, which is what happened with me when I started Tokari at Gombe. I was criticized by the European Union, actually. And they said, but you can't do it all. You've got to concentrate. You've got to focus on one thing. And I said, what is the point of focusing on one thing? What's the point of educating a girl who goes back to her village and dies because of lack of hygienic, So actually the first grant we got was one of these single things. It was replanting trees. But the second grant we got was enabling us to spread out to these other, you know, interrelated problems.
I mean, you just mentioned it as well. There's many different ways of tackling this challenge, but you chose, you know, to step away from science and become an activist. Why and when did you make this decision?
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Well, in 1986, of course, I'd got my PhD by then. I built up a research station at Gombe. I was able to spend hours out in the rainforest learning about the ecosystem, learning more about the chimps. And I thought I'd be there forever. You know, it's that program, by the way, Gombe is still going after 62 years. We still have research going on there, still learning new things. But anyway, 1986, by that time, there were, I think it was six other chimp study sites across Africa. When I began, it was just me. And so we decided to bring scientists from those six groups together for the first time, just the chimp people. And the main thing was, does chimp behavior differ depending on the environment from one place to another? Is there such a thing as culture? And the answer to both is yes. You know, chimps are very adaptable. They can adapt to new conditions in the most amazing way. Like where it's very, very hot in Senegal, chimps will do a lot of foraging at night because it's cooler. You wouldn't dream of doing that in Gombe, that sort of thing. And also they have different tool-using behaviors. But at the same time, we had a session on conservation. And that's when I realized what was happening across Africa. And that's when I got the money. But I didn't make the decision. People say it must have been a very difficult decision. It was something that changed inside me. I went as a scientist, planning a lovely life in the forest. And I came out at the end of 4 days, knowing I had to try and do something, that I had to.
Relating to this, maybe, right now we see so many people, you know, many scientists getting involved in more radical protests. Do you think the role of science is changing in a way?
Well, I think we need both. We still need the careful studies because that helps you with, you know, to conserve a species. But also we need activism to try and make change. So we need both.
Would you consider doing something more radical if things stay the same, or is that something where you would draw a line?
I would never do something really radical. Like, you know, when I approach a politician or a CEO, I don't attack them. I don't say, it's your fault, what you're doing, you've got to change. Because quite honestly, I think mostly, especially if they're, you know, high-ranking males, they're not going to listen. They're just going to be thinking, why should I listen to her? And what does she know about economics? And, you know, so, but I find the way to reach them is, first of all, try and find out one thing where you can relate to each other. Maybe you both like dogs. Maybe you both have a grandchild. I don't know, something, anything. And then find a story. Listen to them first. They may have ideas you hadn't thought of. Then find a story, because you've got to reach the heart. That's the key. They've got to change from within. And it's happening now for various reasons. Many, many corporations are changing the way they operate. You know, I was just had a talk with the CEO of MasterCard this morning. It's amazing what they're doing. You can Google it and find out all that they're doing for the environment. So they're making much less profit, but they're helping to save the planet.
I think one reason why people are becoming more radical is because they are suffering under this ecological grief. And it's no wonder, because the state of nature is so shockingly bad. So do you also have this feeling of ecological grief? Do you suffer from
if you care? You can't look at what's happening and not feel depressed. But, you know, people come to me, especially younger people, so often and say, you know, look at the state of the world and I feel helpless. What can I do? I feel hopeless. And you know, we have this expression, I don't know if you have it in Austria, but we have this thing, think globally, act locally. You have that? It's the wrong way around. If you think globally, you're bound to be depressed. There's nothing for it but to be depressed. But then I say to them, well, what about where you live? Is there a problem there? Like, do you dislike the litter in the street? Are you worried about homelessness? Is there cruel treatment of stray dogs or whatever it is? Well, try and do something about it. Try and persuade others to join you. And if it starts working, that'll make you feel good. Gosh, I have made a difference. And then, because when we feel good, we want to feel better, we do more, and we inspire more to join, because they catch up, you know. And then you realize there's other people in other parts of the world, just like us, doing the same sort of things. Then you dare think globally. So, for example, our program for youth, Roots and Shoots, is now in 65 countries, and they all are linked. So they know, okay, we're planting lots of trees, it makes a difference here. But in 40 other countries, they're also planting trees, also making a difference. Or they're raising money for the homeless, and together we can make an impact on homelessness. And so the program is growing all the time. And so the way to counteract this ecological grief is to take action. Roll up your sleeves and do something. Feel you're making a small difference, which wouldn't make any difference if it was just you. But realize it's not just you. There are hundreds of people. And if you can persuade the other ecologically grief-stricken people who fall into apathy, if you can persuade them to join you, you're making a big difference.
But isn't the real power in politics, or is it really each individual can do something? Because maybe this is also nice for politicians if they say to us, do something, but we don't have to do something. You know what I mean?
We shouldn't listen to the politicians. We should feel every single one of us makes a difference every day. We should take action. We should inspire others to take action. We should try and inspire, as we are doing with consumer pressure, our companies are changing their behavior. We've got to elect and stick by politicians who care about the environment in the future. But too often, I've seen people go into politics with lots of, you know, I'm going to stand up for the environment, stand up for animals. But then they come up against, well, if we do that, it's going to cost me, the public, tiny bit more. So I'm not going to support him anymore or her anymore. So we've got to be prepared to tighten our belts and suffer a tiny bit for the good of the future and the good of the planet. You know, I mean, I became vegan. I've been vegetarian for ages because of ethical reasons. I became vegan because I realized also the ghastly treatment of milk cows and chickens and so on. But you also have to realize that because of the massive meat eating around the world, there are billions and billions of animals in factory farms, and they all have to be fed. And so large areas of natural habitat are cleared to grow the grain, often GMO, by the way. And so you've got these monocultures, which is really bad for biodiversity. And then massive fossil fuel used, all these huge machines, getting the grain to the animals and trucking the animals to abattoirs and meat to the table. Water, scarce in so many parts of the world, takes a lot of water to change vegetable to animal protein. And finally, they're all producing methane, which is a very virulent greenhouse gas. And if you care about our health, which some people do, you can switch people by saying, well, these poor animals in factory farms, they have to be fed antibiotics routinely just to keep them alive, which means the bacteria can build up resistance, which means there are now some conditions that no antibiotic will cure anymore. You get the super bugs in hospitals, which is one reason why people get thrown out of hospitals so quickly.
Just an add-on question. When did you become a vegan?
Well, I was sort of doing a lot of veganism, but when the pandemic began and I was here, I'm talking to you from the house where I grew up, by the way, I thought, well, now I'm here, I can be totally vegan.
Really? You changed your mind at 86?
Yes.
Wow. That's cool.
Absolutely. But, you know, learning more about it, and because when you're traveling all the time, it's not easy to be vegan. I mean, you can, and I'm not sure when I'm starting back on the road, I'll do my best, but I'm not going to starve just because, you know, because after all the animal's been killed. But I talk about it, and more people are becoming vegan, and it's getting easier because there's more vegan food. I mean, the flights will offer you vegan food, which used to be ghastly. I mean, it was a bit of tough old raw carrot and stuff. But now vegan meals are really nice.
I can recommend it as well to most people.
I mean, you can get alternatives to almost everything that's vegan. And it's delicious. Jeez, you can't tell the difference. And some of the alternatives to meat, they're so like meat, I can't eat them because I don't like meat anymore.
I've returned burgers before thinking it was meat because
it's just the same. But, you know, for people who feel they can't live without the taste of meat, that's the way to go. It doesn't matter how you get them to be vegan, as long as they, well, at least try to have a more plant-based diet. That's the way to put it. Try and eat less meat.
Maybe one more question about this. Is it really so easy to make those right choices and environmentally friendly choices when, I mean, you've mentioned it before, when, you know, we have very strong forces and a lot of corruption and a lot of companies trying, you know, to sell us something that really isn't what it says it is?
Well, as more and more people get to understand and more people are refusing to eat the meat, you know, companies will have to change. The main thing is we should close down factory farms. And, you know, if people are really wedded to meat, if you have animals who are living outside and everybody has to die, and if they're killed in a humane way, you know, there's worse ways to die and worse ways to live. So I'm sort of never hardline, because I don't think it gets you anywhere. If you meet somebody who loves meat and you say, you've got to stop eating meat, don't you realize you're helping to destroy the planet? They're not going to change. But if you just gently tell them what meat eating is doing to the planet, then you talk about the alternatives to meat, and you just do it gently. But when I gave up at the beginning, became a vegan, there were some things I really missed. And when I became vegetarian, which was back in the early 70s, I did miss some things. I missed bacon. But the fact that I'd given it up deliberately made me feel, you know, noble. I've given it up. I'm doing something. And it's hurting me, but I'm doing it for the animals. And that makes you feel good.
Maybe speaking of the animals, your beloved chimps, what are the biggest threats to the chimps today?
Well, it's still deforestation, I'm afraid. It's still bushmeat trade, which, you know, is the commercial hunting of wild animals for food, and some countries eat chimps, but it's getting less and less because it's illegal in all African countries. And the governments are beginning to allow those who care to confiscate illegally caught chimps. But, you know, still mothers are killed to steal babies to sell internationally. But we're clamping down on animal trafficking too. There's very strong, powerful groups working with Interpol on shutting down animal trafficking and their parts. And then there's a threat of disease as people move further into their habitat. Those are the main threats. There's also, they often catch a hand or a foot in a wire snare. It's not set for the chimps. It won't kill them. They used to have vine snares and the chimps could just break them and they rotted, but they can break the wire. It's by then knotted, so they can't get it out. And so many of them lose a hand or a foot.
I wanted to ask you about this initiative in Basel, in the Swiss city, where they demanded basic rights for primates.
All animals should have the right to a decent life, not just the primates. You know, elephants are just as deserving of rules to make sure they're treated well. And whales, and, you know, I support it to give them rights, but there's human rights, and they're violated every single day all around the world. So giving them rights by itself isn't going to make that much difference. To me, it's human responsibility. It's helping people understand that animals do matter, that they're individuals, that we depend on this biodiversity, rather than giving them legal rights, because, I mean, think of how we violate human rights all the time, all over the world.
But it would make a difference if animals would have human rights in Austria.
Not human rights. You can't.
Or rights, basic rights.
Right, basic rights. Right.
Yeah.
It's. I would never, as I say, I support it. It's not what I fight for, but I support it. Because in some countries, it can make a difference. And as you say, in Austria, well, if you gave pigs rights, they wouldn't be, you couldn't have factory farms. Same with cows and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you wouldn't be able to have animal labs either, medical labs.
The farmers would be disappointed.
Well, the farmers can do things in other ways. We always have to try to provide alternatives,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they can turn to growing vegetables. They can become involved in alternatives. There's lots of things that can be done. And there will always be some people buying humanely farmed animal products. you know, chickens running around in the fields.
Okay, bist du noch?
Die letzte?
Ja, dann noch, genau.
You know, as I say, I do support those working rights for animals. I mean, a lot of lawyers I know, and I respect them a lot. And we need everything. We need every little aspect to help animals today. It's just not something I'm personally deeply involved with.
Yeah, maybe speaking about this and coming back to the hope thing, you clearly make such a big difference in the world and you inspire so many people. And you mentioned it already, but maybe again, like, which advice would you give to young people who want to make a difference and who do feel depressed maybe?
Well, I would give them the advice that my wonderful mother, who is up here, when I was 10 and decided to go to Africa and live with wild animals and write books about them. Everybody laughed at me. How will you do that? World War II was raging. We didn't have money. I mean, we really didn't have much money at all. And Africa's far away. And you're just a girl. That's what I was told. But not my mother. She said, Jane, if you want to do something like this, you're going to have to work really, really hard. You're going to have to take advantage of every opportunity. And then if you don't give up, hopefully you find a way. I tell that to young people all around the world, particularly in disadvantaged communities, particularly girls in disadvantaged communities. And I wish Mum was alive still so I could let her know the number of people who write and say, thank you, I did follow my dreams, I've been successful, and it's made all the difference. So that, you know, the main advice is, if you really want to do something, you've got to really want to do it. Don't give up, follow your dream. And remember, every day you live, you make a difference, and you can choose what sort of difference you make. Join Roots and Shoots. I would say to them, please join us in Roots and Shoots because you're not changing the world. They, you know, I get letters again all the time saying, Roots and Shoots changed my life. And these people who are now adult, I keep meeting them and they say, gosh, that Roots and Shoots program really changed me. It really gave me a feeling that there's things I could do which I never thought I could do before. And they also, you know, we try and bring them together from different countries, usually virtually. But they get to understand without us telling them that much more important than the color of your skin, your language, your religion, whatever, much more important than all of that is the fact that we're all human beings. We all laugh, we all cry, we all bleed.
You give a lecture about hope in Vienna, and you have written a book about it. What's so important for you, this hope? Why is it so important for you
if you don't have hope, if you do something and you don't hope that it's going to make a difference, why bother? Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Hope is just one of the most important human drivers towards, you know, making a better world. You must be able to hope. Like if you're unjustly in prison.
But even the nature is degrading, you still have hope?
What?
The nature, the state is worsening and it's
worsening, but on the other hand, we hear mostly the bad news, the doom and the gloom. That's what's in the media.
But it's also the scientific consensus. So the science is telling us that it's getting worse.
Well, it is getting worse. But what I'm going to say is I've had the advantage of going around the world and meeting incredible people, amazing projects, showing that if you really care and you get together, you can reverse what's happening. You can save animals on the brink of extinction. I wrote a whole book about it. I wrote that book. Okay, some animals have become extinct, but many have been saved. Environments have been saved, like all around Gombe with the trees coming back. The animals come back as well. So yes, it's grim, but there's hope there because of what we can do. And that's why my life is devoted to helping people understand the importance of what we're doing to the planet, with degrading the environment, but also giving them, you know, let's do something about it, not just talk about it and tell people, well, it's too late. It's not too late if we take action. We've got to take action, though. So that's why people like you in the media, so important to share also the good stories, the success stories. Oh, if they can do it, I can do it. And that's what's going to get us out of this. I don't know if we have time, but I will die fighting for that. I will die fighting to give people hope and to realize that each one of them makes a difference.
Das war der Falter Podcast. Sie hörten ein Interview mit der Naturschutzikone Jane Goodall. Live kann man sie bei einer Veranstaltung des Jane Goodall Instituts am 31. Mai in Wien sehen.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hallo liebe Hörerinnen und Hörer, hier spricht Florian Schäuber. Mein Podcast Schäuber fragt nach läuft wieder auf einem eigenen Schäuber fragt nach Kanal. In der neuen Folge berichte ich, wer Karin Kneißl für Russland angeheuert und für welche Ermordungen ein österreichischer Beamter Verbesserungsvorschläge hat. Mit dem Ungarn-Korrespondenten Stefan Oschwart spreche ich über Orbans Clankriminalität, Gauner-Solidarität mit Putin und Chancen einer Enturbanisierung. Jetzt auf Schäuber fragt nach, überall dort, wo es Podcasts gibt.